Our last case for oral argument is United States v. Hamilton. Good morning.
May it please the Court, William Glasser for the United States. Mathis identified three sources for the Court to consult when determining whether or not statutory alternatives are elements or means. Those three sources are state case law, the text of the statute, and the underlying record. In this case, all three sources indicate that Oklahoma second-degree burglary is divisible because a jury must find, or the defendant must admit to, the burglary of a single location. If we turn first to the state court decisions, the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals has held for a very long time that an indictment for second-degree burglary must allege every fact necessary to the commission of the offense, including the time, place, ownership, and a description of the premises. Now, that's consistent with the way that Oklahoma has always treated the crime of burglary. Burglary is a crime that is completed upon the act of entry, breaking and entering. And therefore, if a defendant breaks or enters multiple locations, he's actually committed more than one burglary. Therefore, the various alternative locations in the statute, Oklahoma has always treated those as being individual single elements that must be alleged and proven to a jury.
And the Ouija instruction, I think, says that, as you point out in your appeal brief, that those, if the evidence supports multiple locations, those should all be included within the Ouija instruction with regard to the locational element in the disjunctive, right?
Your Honor, that is how the initial instructions of the Oklahoma Uniform Jury Instructions, they say that they should be charged in the alternative, but that's, I think, inconsistent with the case law and inconsistent with the specific burglary instruction in the Uniform Jury Instructions that requires identification of a specific location. So although the general instruction says if the evidence supports more than one, charge in the alternative, that's not consistent with the state's long-standing practice. And in fact, as we point out,
and that's what you argue in your reply brief. Well, the prosecutors don't do that, but I'm not sure that the prosecutors don't abide by the instruction of the Ouija instruction is a really good counter to the idea that the law in Oklahoma is what the Ouija instruction and the commentary says.
Well, Your Honor, again, if I may push back a little bit, it's the introductory provisions to the Ouija instruction that say that if there's evidence of more than one alternative, include in the disjunctive. But if we look at the specific instruction, so instruction 5-11, which it applies to burglary, it says that it requires a description of the premises. And then the footnote says the time, place, date, and description of the premises must be proved by the state to sustain the conviction and cites the state case law. So I don't think that the introductory instruction can trump the specific instruction that applies to burglary. But again, this is, as we pointed out in our reply and argued initially in our opening brief, the long-standing practice has been to choose one locational element. And that actually lines up with the third Mathis factor, the underlying record in this case. The record in this case, in each case, alleged a burglary of a single location, a building or residence. And I cited a number of cases where that is the long-standing practice in Oklahoma. So it's true that, getting back to the first element, the state court decisions, it's true that Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals has never considered whether, if something is charged in the alternative, whether or not the jury must be unanimous on the single location. And the reason it hasn't had to reach that question, the way that the Iowa Supreme Court had done in Mathis, is that it simply isn't done as a matter of regular practice. In other words, it hasn't had to reach the question of jury unanimity because the jury must always be unanimous because it's always charged a single locational alternative. The most analogous case to this case, to this Oklahoma statute, is the Gundy case that I cited out of the 11th Circuit. Now, there is one distinction in that the statute in this case says, or other structure or erection. But, as Gundy reasoned, when a prosecutor is required to charge a single locational alternative, that is the quintessential divisible statute. The statute in this case is much more similar to the statute in Gundy than it is to, for example, the statute in Mathis, and in some of the other cases that we've lost in other circuits.
So if someone is charged with breaking and entering a building, which would fall within the enumeration of a building, and then or other erection or structure, which would encompass a building, so there are two separate locational descriptions that refer to the same building, the same location. Wouldn't the fact that the other structure or erection, or however it's phrased, the fact that it encompasses other locational items that are enumerated, wouldn't that foreclose those from being separate elements?
No, Your Honor, it doesn't foreclose them from being separate elements. I concede that it does, to a certain extent, weigh against our argument in that it is more inclusive and can include some of the other terms. However, I don't think that it reasonably includes all the other terms, as Mr. Hamilton contends. For example, an automobile, a truck, a trailer, those things, especially an automobile or a truck, are not ordinarily considered to be structures or erections. Structure or erection tends to refer more to buildings. But even then, even if they all could fall within that broad term, that doesn't discount the fact that the legislature chose to enumerate all of those alternative locations. And in the ordinary course of things, the prosecutor is going to choose a more specific alternative rather than the broad general structure or erection. Structure or erection most likely was an attempt by the legislature to include certain locations that it hadn't specifically enumerated, but that were similar to those other locations. So, for example, Mr. Hamilton has cited a case that from the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals involving a fenced lumber yard that was attached to a building. And that the court concluded that that was a structure or erection similar to building and therefore fell within the statute.
Now, here, the charge we have, it includes the word residence?
Your Honor, with respect to the 2004 conviction, not with there were two convictions in 75. Those both said building. And Mr. Hamilton does point out the residence is not one of the locations that is enumerated in the second-degree burglary statute. It is more similar to the term dwelling, which is actually the first-degree burglary, which is the first-degree burglary statute. But the simple fact that it uses a term that's not included specifically in the statute doesn't undermine the government's position that, first of all, the state courts require the choosing of a single location, and secondly, that the term residence, it would ordinarily be understood to be a building, but at least falls within a structure or erection. So it's true that in that 2004 situation, the prosecutor did not select a term that is specifically enumerated in the statute, but that doesn't undermine the government's position. In fact, the prosecutor, a single prosecutor using a term that perhaps isn't as precise as it could be.
Let me make sure I understand this argument.
Sure.
If a statute criminalizes the entry into a dwelling, which includes a residence, I think, as one class of crime, and another statute categorizes any number of other types of buildings and uses the generic term structures, erections, etc., as a different classification of crime, that you can elect to charge a entry of a dwelling as to the same as if under the second statute, because a dwelling is a structure?
Your Honor, no, I don't think that would ordinarily be the appropriate method. So, again, in the 2004 case, it was not charged as first-degree burglary, and it wasn't charged as a dwelling. It was charged as a residence. So they're a little bit different.
But you're not going to argue there with a straight face that there's a difference between a dwelling and a residence.
No, Your Honor, there isn't. But first of all, just as a practical matter of prosecutorial discretion, the prosecutor may charge a lesser included offense, such as second degree burglary, even if there might be evidence indicating that it was in fact a dwelling and would therefore qualify for first degree burglary. But in the 2004 case, for whatever reason, the prosecutor chose to use the word residence rather than the word building or structure or erection or something else within the second-degree burglary statute, but still chose one single location. And so that's not inconsistent with the government's view that the statute as a whole is divisible between those alternative locations.
Even if it's a location that's not in the statute.
Your Honor, yes.
You're giving the prosecutor a lot of leeway here.
Well, Your Honor, that might be true, but the statute does. The statute says, or other structure or erection. The legislature's intent here seems to be to include a broad range of buildings or other structures, which is consistent with the generic burglary definition from the Supreme Court in Taylor.
Like a mobile home, for example?
Your Honor, I believe a mobile home would fall within the definition of structure or erection. That's correct.
And that would fall outside the generic conception of burglary, would it not?
A mobile home, Your Honor? Certainly not in the government's position. We've lost that issue in the Sixth Circuit and a petition to the Supreme Court for certiorari, but...
Well, you lost that issue in Ramon Silva, did you not?
Your Honor, I don't believe we lost that precise issue. This court held in spring that that burglary of a dwelling, I'm not remembering the exact word, but even a mobile residence, that actually falls within...
That preceded Shepherd.
That's correct, Your Honor, you did. But the inclusion of a mobile home, I mean, that's obviously not a question that's before the court today, but the inclusion of a mobile home, in the government's view, that would fall within the definition of other structure or erection, and therefore would fall within this statute, and we also believe that it falls within generic burglary. If the court has no further questions, I'll...
Do you think the Oklahoma burglary statute is parallel to the Iowa statute, and therefore the analysis in Mathis applies here, just straight on down the line?
No, Your Honor.
It's the opposite. Because here we're talking about umbrella terms.
Your Honor, in this, there's no umbrella term in this case. The district court found
it. But in Iowa, there was?
That's correct, Your Honor. So Iowa used the term... They used the term occupied dwelling. And that was the only element enumerated in the statute. And then a completely separate statute defined that term broadly to include these other locations that fall outside generic burglary. Here, all of the locations are specifically enumerated in the statute as alternative elements. And that distinguishes it from the state statute in Mathis.
Okay.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, I am Barry Derryberry, appearing for Mr. Hamilton.
You find yourself in a very unusual position to go in second instead of first.
Yes, and on Tuesday...
I saw you go over to the wrong table.
On Tuesday, we did the very same thing. It's deja vu all over again. First things first, I want to point out that as the precedent from March of last year involving a defendant named Ramon Tittle, I think, Judge Briscoe was on that case, does tell us that the Mathis tools that we are looking at are deployed for the purpose of determining if there is certainty that the ACC is applicable. Another first principle that I want to bring up is that in Mathis itself, it says that the statute on its face may resolve the question. I think that it does. And Mathis discusses how we should look for whether or not the statute provides illustrative examples or whether the statute presents disjunctive factual scenarios.
Before you get to Mathis, with regard to the two 1975 burglary convictions, does Snyder impact our analysis? Can we tell from the charging documents that in 1975 the defendant was charged and convicted for breaking and entering a building, which would satisfy the generic definition?
Well, Snyder, when you get past the initial discussion of timeliness in the merits section of the case, it discussed the pre-sentence investigation report, I believe, that, and Snyder said that there may be cases where the pre-sentence investigation report might rely on appropriate Shepherd documents that would provide the answer to the court. And that was done, in fact, in the PSR in Snyder. And so Snyder did not prevail, is my recollection.
Right. So why don't we have the equivalent situation here with regard to the 275 convictions, the Shepherd documents being the charging document and the document of conviction, the judgment of conviction? Do we have enough data points under Snyder for the 75 convictions?
Well, this is a juncture beyond the question of whether or not the statute is divisible or not, because you're only, right, because only the sneak peek that we're doing under Mathis would enable us to look at those documents. I understand that what you're asking is a different question as to the natural application of Shepherd documents and determining whether or not the defendant is.
I'm just trying to ask if Snyder impacts our analysis at all.
Yeah, I don't think that it really plugs in to the analysis because Snyder does not really turn on the issue of what Mathis does as to the divisibility of the statute under examination. Now, in Mathis, we have an example provided by the court of a type of statute in which there are illustrative examples, and they cite some previous Supreme Court case that involves a deadly weapon, in which a statute defines deadly weapon as knives, guns, bats, or similar weapons. And so the initial three possible weapons are illustrations of the broader term, which is similar weapons. And I think that we have something analogous in the Oklahoma statute when you compare the language in section 1435 that says other structure or erection. The government
careful with your tread, because I think the government is arguing that the reason that they can do that, they can interpret a lesser offense in inclusive language, is so that they would have prosecutorial discretion in the case of a burglary of a home to charge either first degree or second degree. And you would say, no, they don't have the discretion to do that. They've got to go with a first degree if a house is involved. Is that what you really want?
Now, a house can be first or second degree burglary as charged in the state of Oklahoma, and first degree has more to do with whether it is occupied.
Right.
But just as the deadly weapon example says similar weapon, and then you've got illustrative examples of that, in our case we have other structure or erection, which at page 19 of the government's opening brief, the government does admit that term, the other, does encompass to some extent the other options. Among these nine options that are previously listed in 1435, to some extent it incorporates or includes those. I think it includes all of them because the intent of the statute seems to be saying that everything preceding this word other is an erection or structure. And I cite Black's dictionary in my brief that defines structure as that which is built or constructed.
So you're saying an automobile is a structure? Is that what you're saying?
Under this definition of Black, a structure is that which is built or constructed, a very broad definition. Yes, because an automobile is built or constructed. And certainly every other state is probably going to have a different outcome. We're divining statutory intent of the legislature in this very, very old criminal statute in Oklahoma. But I think that is an umbrella term. I wasn't involved at that point in the case where Judge Curran issued his order. But I do think, I'm not here to appeal him, but I think that we do have an umbrella term, notwithstanding what his finding is. It's just that the umbrella term is at the end of the statute. And if you, for instance, compare the burglary statute in Utah, which really was dealing with two statutes, interestingly, Justice Kagan, did not reveal in her majority opinion that there were two statutes. She only cited the second one and seems to sort of de-emphasize the fact that there such a structure of the statute that way. But there was an umbrella term, which is a residential structure in one statute. And then another statute said residential structure is the following. So that's an umbrella term at the very beginning. I think we have one also. It's just at the end of the statute, which we often see.
Does the word other not preclude your argument that it is a more encompassing term? Doesn't the placement at the end of the series and the word other indicate that what preceded the word other was distinct from what follows the comma, the other structure or erection. It seems counterintuitive to me that other structure or erection can encompass other, can be duplicative with what preceded that phrase.
Just to utilize, I think, just a very simple type of example, if I say dogs, cats, and other animals, then that, and it's a very normal usage, acknowledges those are animals, but they're illustrative examples. Because you can go on and on filling the list with animals, just like in this case. In the in the briefing in our case, I cite Stanley from the Court of Criminal Appeals that finds that a fenced yard around the lumber yard, that is an outdoors type of area, is a structure or erection. And that's within the scope of the statute. Judge Kern conceived of an example of a tent that is shaped like a booth, and what if it was charged as booth and tent? I'll take that maybe what I feel is a practical place, which is in Tulsa, our homeless population on the Arkansas River consists of a lot of folks that make a lot of makeshift things. And if it's a tarp, it might be a tent, or it might be a booth, or a structure, or an erection.
So if they're sleeping in the car, that's a structure.
It's something that is been built, put together under blacks, in at least the context of this statute.
That's your first creative definition of the word. The Latins used to call them edifices, which I think probably is better. But they didn't use that word, right?
No. So then I think the other thing that we're looking at that is the face of the statute is the example that is given in Mathis on page 2249, Supreme Court Reporter, that says you may
have a case, United States versus Taylor.
Taylor?
Yeah, I don't know if it's an OJ or maybe somebody could enlighten.
It's an OJ.
It is.
It's an
OJ. Unfettered.
But we, in that case, the panel there basically said that the location enumerated in the Oklahoma second-degree burglary statute constitutes alternative means rather than alternative elements. So is that, assuming we choose to follow that line of reasoning, is that dispositive?
Yes. As persuasive authority, it is dispositive.
Yeah, I said if we choose to follow it, that same reasoning, that would be dispositive.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And you agree with that analysis?
Yes. I mean, it does not go through the length of what we are going through in our briefing with all of the tools from Mathis, but
judges a few words.
Judges a few words.
Minutes.
But, I think that relates to what I was about to say, which is 2249 of the Mathis opinion says you may have a burglary statute that might itemize the various places where the crime could occur as disjunctive factual scenarios. And that's what we appear to have. Now, turning to Oklahoma case law to try to deal with this succinctly, I would say that this court should consider that Oklahoma is a Shad versus Arizona jurisdiction, which is a Supreme Court case from 1991 discussed in my brief in the context of it being followed by the Court of Criminal Appeals in the Gilson case. And Shad said that in the context of murder, whether it's murder, malice aforethought, or felony murder, those are alternating means of committing murder because they sort of take the place of the mental state element. So there are two different ways of dealing with it. Oklahoma has signed on to that and deployed it in the Gilson case that says that in the case of child abuse murder, that committing it actually or permitting it to be committed are means by which the crime can be committed. And they sure look like elements, whether somebody actually has perpetrated the act versus stood by and acquiesced in the act. sure look like elements, but they are intended to be means. And
now, your adversary would say Ross versus State would preclude your argument. What's wrong with that? In other words, that in Ross, the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals required the charging document to include a description of the premises.
Ross says that it is essential to the validity of an information that the act charged as the offense, that kind of sounds like a factual thing already, the act charged as the offense shall be clearly and distinctly set forth in ordinary language and in a manner to enable a person of common understanding to know what he's charged with and help him to prepare his defense. And that case and dozens of other Court of Criminal Appeals cases discuss that we expect an information or indictment in the state of Oklahoma to present the elements, but also to enable a defendant to present his to be able to prepare his defense, give notice, in other words, in the sense of due process notice, and to provide a defendant with sufficient information that he could use to subsequently plead jeopardy, subsequent jeopardy as a defense if need be. And so it, you know, all that glitters is not gold, and all that isn't an information is not an element. Even the government citation about the Ouija commentary that says that information should include the time, place, ownership, and description of the premises, I think reflects that those broad multiple concerns with what we expect from an Oklahoma information, because the time is not an element. Time is not is considered not essential to a crime of burglary in jurisprudence in the Court of Criminal Appeals. And then it says place and description of the premises. Well, that's a bit redundant. What's going on? Well, because Oklahoma case law says we would want you to go ahead and give the address or the lot number if you can. That's not in 1435 because of the concern of notice. That is my time. If there's no more questions, thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court. I think that if that we could look at the Oklahoma statute for a long time and sort of talk in circles about how exactly other structure or erection relates to the previously enumerated locations. The statute has an interesting history in that it didn't used to include the terms before 1941, didn't include automobile, truck, or trailer, but it did include railroad car. So the addition of those terms, it might not make a lot of sense as to how those relate, but I think the key point here is that if Mr. Hamilton's position is correct, the government could charge, the state could charge in any case, all of these alternatives in the disjunctive. Now, he would say that, well, that's inconsistent with the notice requirement under state law, but in terms of the actual being able to be convicted, apart from the notice requirement, let's say if somehow it got past that indictment stage, you could charge all of them in the alternative, or the state legislature could have simply said structure or erection and then defined it broadly in another location, as the statute did in Mathis. But instead, the legislature decided for some reason to enumerate all of these distinct locations and then to make sure that it was clear that that wasn't an exclusive list, that there were some other things that were structured or erections that could fall into that. But again, if we look back to the case law, so the statute might not, I don't think the statute on its own would probably decide this issue for the court. But if we look to case law, if we look to the underlying record, the other two Mathis factors, I think that there is enough for this court to be certain that in the state of Oklahoma, the jury must be unanimous on finding a single location that is burgled. Just to answer briefly Judge Lucero's question about the Taylor order and judgment, not only is that an unpublished decision that's not binding on this court, it was also in dicta because the point of decision in Taylor was the timeliness issue. And I think that after Mathis, probably honestly, most of us looked at most burglary statutes and said, goodness, I don't know what's left. But the Taylor case did not go through the detailed analysis that Mathis requires. And going through that analysis, the three factors in this case taken together support the government's contention that this is a divisible statute and that the jury must be unanimous as to the location burglary.
And you do not care about the Louisiana burglary?
Your Honor,
it's not been argued on appeal.
We have
so
not.
So we would not remand for the district court to say, hey, take a look at the Louisiana burglary.
No, Your Honor. I don't think that would be.
You don't want it. You're not arguing it.
We're not arguing it on this appeal. Now, I would point out that there are two other convictions. There's the Oklahoma robbery with firearms and the California assault with a deadly weapon that we think would fall under the elements clause. But Louisiana burglary, I don't think it would be particularly productive for us to argue that issue. The analysis overlaps to some extent with the Oklahoma issue, but that's outside of the circuit and not particularly productive. So we ask the court to reverse.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments this morning. Court is in recess.